You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 18th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello.
Kara is going to be late because her cable is out. Not able to get internet access, but once we get things sorted out, she'll be able to join us later in the show. And the proverbial fates are against us tonight because I had a massive computer problem as well. So I had to move my computer into my wife's office because they're starting the destruction of our house, you know, to fix the water damage. Uh-huh. And I had to reboot my computer. And when I did that, it did a security update. Now, the security update apparently completely borked my computer. My input devices don't work. The USB ports don't work as a result of the patch.
That's a hell of a security patch.
Yeah. So now I'm dead in the water. I have absolutely no way to interact with my computer. And of course, all of the solutions involve input devices that I can't use. So they're worthless.
Oh.
Yeah. In fact, it stopped a lot of people's USB ports all around the world.
Is that considered a security measure?
Now I'm in the process of reinstalling Windows on my main computer, and I'm recording the show from my laptop. But, you know, hopefully at some point during the recording of the show, I'll be able to move over to my main computer. But, yeah, that was a hell of an update.
How about even after, like, rebooting, like, going into the BIOS, hitting F12, one of those things?
I tried everything. I got Jay to help me as well. I obviously rebooted. I tried to, you know, do a BIOS update. I tried to use a different keyboard. I tried to repair Windows, to roll it back to a different version. Nothing worked. Absolutely nothing.
And that's what we get for making fun of the devil last episode. He's getting his
right?
revenge.
Oh, yeah.
Now
QED, obvious.
Back.
That's how he does it, Ev.
Doesn't he? He or she? I mean, really?
So Art Bell is dead.
Yes, Art Bell. Oh, gosh.
Wasn't that last week?
It was sudden.
Was it like an alien abduction gone awry? What happened?
Yeah, so Art Bell was the original host of the Coast to Coast AM show, which is a late night radio show that was conspiracy mongering. Like, he believed in every conspiracy, you know? Really developed a loyal audience of conspiracy theorists. And he would, like, pretend like he's, like, broadcasting from a secret bunker, and, you know, the government's onto him. And it was really innovative. I mean, he
definitely. Perry and I used to listen to him way back when.
Create that genre of radio show, you know? Now, Perry and I had one small interaction with him. Perry actually called the show in order to see if we can get on there as a guest or to talk about these issues from a skeptical angle. And so Perry calls the number, and Art Bell himself answers the phone. Like, he was screening his own calls. He was really like a one-man show at that point. It was really funny. Now, unfortunately, we never got on the show. It never worked out. But, you know, Perry said he was personable. He was a friendly guy. I think he was just doing his job, you know. But that was as close as we came to getting on the Art Bell show.
Oh.
I recall a conversation with Perry about Art Bell, and I wish I could remember the finer details, but essentially, he had either read or heard from someone or somewhere that at some point Art Bell had sort of admitted that what he did on his show, he did certainly for entertainment value, that he did not necessarily believe in some or most of what was going on. In a way, he sort of took on the persona of Art Bell, sort of like the way we talk about Alex Jones assuming a persona for his radio show. So I saw it. That was an interesting little parallel, I think.
And speaking of Alex Jones, Alex Jones is getting sued for defamation.
Mm-hmm.
He's getting sued by parents of victims of the Sandy
Hook
shooting. Yeah.
For what in particular?
So they're accusing him of deliberately lying to say that they were lying about their kids getting shot. Like, there was, you know, Sandy Hook was a false flag, that there were no kids who were killed. It was a government operation. The parents were all crisis actors. Their kids never existed, et cetera. And that resulted in them getting inundated with death threats and harassment by, you know, crazy conspiracy theorists. You know, really had a dramatic effect on their emotional well-being, on their quality of life, did, you know, real harm to them while they're struggling to deal with already, you know, to deal with this incredible tragedy. So, yeah, we'll have to see where that goes. It's going to be, I think, an interesting case, you know?
That's a high bar. It seems like a high bar.
Tough to pull off.
They will have to prove that Alex Jones deliberately lied, that or he was totally indifferent to the truth, that his claims are in fact wrong, and that they caused demonstrable harm. That is the standard, at least in the United States. So it can't just be he was mean, you know. It has to be, you know, he's not just stating his opinion. It's not hyperbole. That these are factual claims that he knew to be wrong or was indifferent to whether or not they were right or wrong, and that they caused harm. So we'll see. We'll see if they could meet that bar. It's interesting. It'll be an interesting case to follow.
Yeah, but he's never made that clear, you know. Like, he's not like he has a disclaimer before his show. I mean, he knows damn well what he's doing.
Well, we don't know if he knows what he's doing or not. So I, you know, there is reason to think, and we've talked about this, that he is he's acting. This is a persona, a personality that he puts on. And that is a case that he made during his a recent custody, you know, battle that he's having. He's like, hey, listen, I'm not this crazy guy that on the show. That's just a character that I'm playing, you know, or at least his lawyer made that argument on his behalf. And that may bite him in the butt now, because if that's true, like, I guess it can kind of cut both ways. The question is, can he say, you know, you can't hold me accountable for the things that my character says. It's clearly just for entertainment value. But as you say, Jay, he's never made that clear. He's deliberately, you know, in the gray zone there, and that court will have to sort that out.
$1 million?
Yeah, it's going to be – they're suing him for more than $1 million.
You know, but think about how – oh, man. It's such a difficult thing, because, of course, I believe in free speech. I mean, our lawsuit
– Yeah, I mean, in our lawsuit, it's easy. I mean, there's – you know, the Tobinick is saying that my article is commercial speech, when, in fact, it is clearly opinion. Right, I am giving my professional and personal opinion about the state of the evidence with regard to specific treatments, and it, you know, the court's ruled that it's clearly opinion. It's held up on appeal, so that is a totally different issue. In this case, you know, they're alleging specific factual claims that are dramatically and knowingly wrong. So it's a very different situation.
But in this case, you know, with Alex Jones, we're talking about him fear-mongering a conspiracy theory that, you know, the whole thing was a setup and that the parents are lying about losing their children. And, you know, that's where the death threats are coming from. Not just him, of course. I mean, his death threats are coming – would have come, I think, either way. But he was throwing fuel on that fire. And I can't – you know, the skeptic in me, after the skeptic in me cringes and cries a little bit, I want to freak out. You know, I'm like, what the hell? Like, you know, it's not okay to blatantly lie. I mean, you know, anybody with any rational thinking going on is not going to believe that those parents and, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of people are lying about those kids getting killed in the school. You know, at the time I was living, you know, 2 or 3 miles from where it actually took place. Mm-hmm. And driving through that town every day. I mean, this was not concocted under any circumstance, and it's easy to prove.
Yeah, I mean, it's absurd. You know, not only that, Jay, but like, we have friends, very close, childhood friends of Evan, parents who had several children in the school. She was there. She was standing outside the smashed-in window where the killer broke in.
Yeah, the main entrance, yeah.
Yeah, and while hearing gunfire going on in the school, knowing that her kids were in there, her husband is a first responder. He was there. He saw the bodies. I mean, you know, we would all have to be involved in the conspiracy. We would have to be part of the conspiracy. The whole town would have to be a network of people for several towns around. I mean, it would be impossible to fake something like that. Just absolutely absurd.
Yeah, and I think some of the conspiracies are revolving around the idea that this is just to take our guns away.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But the point is, my point is,
what is your
point?
You
know, where do you? It's the line. It's always the line, Bob. Where do you draw the line? You know, like, should Alex Jones be able to continue to rant about something that is so obviously and so easily provable? You know, he's saying that these people are lying and encouraging ill will towards these parents whose lives are ruined.
Well, only to the extent that he cannot cause harm to others. And that's what a court needs to decide.
I agree. I agree, Evan. You're right. Court needs to decide.
All right, Bob, get us started on the news item. This is going to be about a new technology that has to do with communicating without actually speaking.
Yeah, this one was fascinating and a little weird. So MIT has developed a prototype device that uses sub-vocalizations to allow you to communicate using natural language utterly silently and undetectably. And
total silence.
So this is what the researchers claim that their device called Alter Ego can do. So the device itself wraps around your ear and kind of hugs a small part of your neck and face. And yeah, it looks a little weird, maybe even a lot weird. But it's kind of cool, maybe. But I think this is just – and this is a prototype after all. So Arnav Kapoor, who led the system's development, said, "Our idea was, could we have a computing platform that's more internal, that melds human and machine in some ways, and that feels like an internal extension of our own cognition?" So that's a tall order, I think. But it seems like they've really made some progress in that. So there's two key technologies here that allowed this to happen. Most importantly, this device detects and interprets and transmits what's called sub-vocalizations or silent speech. So often when your brain thinks about an action, your body actually prepares to carry it out, and it does so in ways that are detectable. So this is true, for example, of many of your dream actions that you mentally engage in every night. You know, you dream like you're doing something, you're running, you're jumping. Your body kind of tries to do it in certain ways. In fact, your body is so tempted to do what you dream, that's why you're paralyzed, so you don't actually act out your dream and fall out your window. So when you specifically pronounce words in your mind, the muscles surrounding your mouth and your throat, they kind of get ready to actually form those words and say them, but they stop at the last moment and they don't do it. But when you're actually saying those words internally, it's kind of happening in the background. So at the far end of the spectrum, there you have people, and we've all done this or seen people. These are people who read when they're reading, they're silently mouthing the words, right? You see people that do that, and that's a kind of a sub-vocalization that's actually manifesting itself in an involuntary way into actually, you know, making the movements, if not actually, you know, doing everything except actually saying the words. So Alter Ego, it's actually like some of the advanced prosthetics out there. They measure the neuromuscular signals created by your intention to move your lost limb, and then they translate them into electrical signals that your prosthetic limb can act on. So this is electromyography. So Alter Ego performs a similar task, but this is actually more difficult because when you're using language, it's actually much more difficult, which is why, you know, it's taken this long to even have something like this. Although there have been similar platforms in the past, but this one, at least the prototype, outperforms them. So it has 16 electrodes in the prototype, and they're saying that they can get that down to 4 electrodes to perform almost as well, or essentially as well as 16 electrodes. So the electrodes gather the signals, which are then compared to templates, essentially, that are stored in the neural network. So this device then can use these silent subvocalizations to send commands that would then go to an AI assistant like Alexa or Siri, or to a device, or eventually even to other people, which is one of the probably one of the real major goals here. So that's outbound. For the inbound communication, to really make this like a two-way communication, the device uses bone conduction speakers. Now, these, you've probably heard of these before. These transmit sounds through the bones in your head right into your inner ear. So the reason why this is important in the context of the silent communication is that it means that you're still aware of your sound environment and you're not isolating yourself as you would if you were putting in some earbuds to listen to music or talk on the phone. You know, you can still be fully engaged in your soundscape, your normal soundscape, while still listening to whatever communication might be coming back through these bone conductors, through the Alter Ego. So you can't just strap these on, and start using them, which probably makes sense. You probably anticipated that. It takes some training. But for testing the prototype, the testers only had to calibrate for 10 minutes, which is really not long at all. And I like how the researchers said that it takes time for the device to learn your accent. you know, your neurological accent in a sense, because everybody's a little bit different, which is why you can't just jump on this thing and start using it, or it jumps on you, I suppose. So right now, Alter Ego only has a few testing platforms, if you will. One is for math, so you could ask it, you know, silently. You could say, you know, what's 175,312 plus 17,965, whatever. You can just ask these subvocally, these large numbers, and you could do math, you could subtraction and addition, whatever. Another one is playing games of chess. Now, both are set up to use 20 commands. So they have a limited vocabulary. But even with that, they said they gained, they had a 92% accuracy testing the prototype. And Kapoor said that that would probably improve with regular use. So, you know, you're getting low to mid 90s, 90 percentile in accuracy. That's pretty damn good. And it's pretty encouraging, I think. So regarding the future, Kapoor said, I think we'll achieve full conversation someday. And so what are you going to do with all this stuff? What's the benefit here? Well, there's a lot, I think. One is it's useful in noisy environments. I was at a concert recently, and it was just so loud that, I mean, if you wanted to communicate with somebody, it was almost impossible. You know, you would essentially have to shout in their ear. But with this device, think about it. You're in a noisy environment so loud that you can't even hear anything. You could communicate with a device, with Siri, you could communicate with somebody across the noisy room using this technology. Or how about in an environment where silence is required? A library comes to mind, but also movie theater. How about military operations where stealth is paramount? I remember we were playing paintball years ago. We had these communication devices strapped to our heads, conventional audio, microphone we were all linked together, and it was really cool because if you know paintball, you didn't have to shout. We were just talking very silently to each other, and I remember the opposing team saying that they were kind of freaked out because they couldn't hear us at all because there was no noise except for our movement. And so imagine this is that technology on steroids. I mean, you imagine even a whisper would be too loud compared to this thing. You could just essentially think the words and have them communicated. One of the other big uses is for anyone that is voice impaired. If you literally can't speak, but if you still have the use of the muscles in your jaw and face, then you could still essentially talk to people using this device, even though you cannot produce any sound at all. So like I said, this is a prototype, but I think the results they've had are incredibly encouraging, and I'll be really interested to see how this develops over the ensuing 5 to 10 years and what they could eventually achieve with this. Cool stuff.
Yeah, so Bob, are you thinking like early use would be like people talking to each other through their helmets, like if it were like a strike team or something like that, like a military use in the very beginning?
Sure. For military use, I remember watching Ghost in the Shell animated episodes years ago, and they were communicating with each other completely silently. Now, these were people that they were basically cyborgs. So, I mean, they probably weren't using anything like this. I mean, they probably had radio receivers and antennas and whatever communications they needed. Their phones were essentially in their skulls. So, but it reminded me of that because they were thinking these thoughts and communicating them. So this would be similar to that, Jay. And yeah, I mean, military use, I'm sure they might. Who knows? They might start putting some money into this. For military use, because it could really come in handy for, when you're on a stealth mission and you can imagine communicating using natural language without making a sound, a peep, or controlling devices or robots or whatever just by thinking the commands. Oh, man, that's a, it could be a game changer.
Another question, like, would you actually be able to hear the person's voice?
Well, that's just it. Yeah, that's, I thought of that. That's right now the way they're thinking about this is, I mean, it wouldn't be like talking on the phone. I would assume that initially you would be hearing, a translation of your voice, and it could be a little bit robotic. But I mean, I don't think it's an insurmountable problem that they could have, a template of your vocalizations in the database, and it could fairly faithfully reproduce, your voice using this technology. But yeah, it wouldn't exactly be like talking to somebody on the phone, but it would be, robotic language is getting, pretty subtle and nuanced these days. So I think you could have a pretty regular conversation with this device, even if it doesn't sound exactly like the person you're talking to.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Evan, you are going to tell us about how especially wealthy Americans know less about nutrition than they think they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I saw this at Real Clear Science, their aggregator, and it was picked up from the website, theconversation.com. And the headline reads, "Wealthy Americans know less than they think they do about food and nutrition." It was an article by Cheryl Kirschenbaum and Douglas Bueller. And well, here's the summary of the results of their study. Yeah, Bueller. What their findings revealed is that household income has a significant influence on access to information and shapes attitudes about diet and nutrition, which I don't think is surprising. But higher income does not consistently correlate with better understanding. And they reached this conclusion based on the latest food literacy and engagement poll, which was conducted just over a year ago from Michigan State University's Food at MSU initiative. And the poll finds that for households earning at least $50,000 annually, 49% of those households believe that they know more than the average person about global food systems. By comparison, households under $50,000 per year, only 28% of those households believe that they're better than average in understanding food systems. Now, in the same survey, respondents were asked if they avoid products containing chemicals when purchasing groceries. And they deliberately left the term chemical as undefined. They just said products containing chemicals when purchasing groceries. 73% of respondents with high incomes said, yes, they avoid products containing chemicals. And 65% of people living in lower income households also said that they avoid buying the chemicals. Now, I think that's a pretty revealing disconnect between the population as a whole and basic science literacy. I mean, when this, regardless of the difference, whether it's 65% or 73%, I think either way, it's too many people who just do not understand the word chemical, and they're exposing themselves as just not having this basic understanding of science. And I think that what this part of the poll concludes is perhaps the Dunning-Kruger effect once again is ruling the day, in that the people with moderate to higher incomes, when compared to those of the poorer incomes, the higher incomes tend to be worse at overestimating their perceived base of knowledge when it comes to food. So that was that part of the survey. But they touched on some other things in the survey. The poll supports prior research suggesting that poorer people overall appear to have less access to information about health, safety, and nutrition. And they cite this example. Just 59% of lower earning Americans recognize the term bisphenol A, BPA, which is an industrial chemical in some plastics and resins that can seep into food and beverages, that they've recognized the term. But by contrast, 80% of wealthier consumers are familiar with the term. And only 85% of lower income respondents were familiar with the term GMOs, compared to 93% of higher earners. So in a weird way, I think, that may not be a bad thing nowadays for people to be less familiar maybe with the term GMO due to the anti-GMO movements having hijacked the term for their anti-science crusade. So I thought that was interesting and sort of leads to another point of the survey where they observed that even though higher earners have more access to information about food, they are also more likely to be influenced by misinformation and pseudoscience. So for example, in the survey, 43% of those with the higher incomes reported that they avoid purchasing GMO foods, while only 26% of lower earners reported that they avoid purchasing GMO foods. And I suppose that those who either can afford to have 24/7 online access, just that higher level of internet information that they can get, they're more likely to drink from the fire hydrant in the internet. And in doing so, for all the good information that's out there, they're consuming 10 times that number in garbage, lies, propaganda, and all the other stuff that goes along with it. So those were the main points of the study that they were able to pull out.
Well, I have to point out that 49% of the people in the higher income bracket saying they had an above average knowledge of nutrition is actually appropriate, right? I mean, half should be above average by definition if you have a normal distribution. The more important thing here, I think, is the, as you say, the disconnect in terms of information, but also misinformation. And I think that could just reflect a couple of things. One, just generically, higher socioeconomic status clearly equates with more access to the internet, more access to information in general. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think there's a confidence issue here, as you say, kind of a Dunning-Kruger type effect, where having access to a little bit more information makes you a lot more confident in your opinions, makes you much more likely to go against the consensus of scientific opinion because you think you're well informed. I have all this information. I've done, quote unquote, done my research on the internet. Therefore, if my opinions seem out of the mainstream, I earned that opinion because I've looked up all this information. And again, it shows how critical it is to be able to not only access information but to evaluate it critically. And that's the thing that doesn't happen until you either get to very high levels of science education or have specific, education in critical thinking itself, and that does not automatically come with higher socioeconomic status.
Yeah, I don't think you're surprised by the results of any of this. It supports what we've talked about before and what we've read before.
Yeah, it's pretty consistent with, our activism over the last 20 years. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that disposable income correlates really well, not only with higher education, but also with utilizing alternative medicine and a lot of woo unscientific things. I think because of these phenomena that we're talking about. All right, Jay, tell us all about rare earth elements.
All right, so I'm sure most of you have heard the phrase rare earth or rare earth metals or rare earth elements, but what exactly are they? I'm going to tell you, a rare earth element or metal is one of a set of 17 chemical elements in the periodic table. So if you're looking at a periodic table, they're on row 6 and they're numbered 57 to 71. There should be 15 in there. And then there are also two others that you could add to that list, scandium and yttrium. Scandium is 21 and yttrium is number 39. And these are called lanthanides. An interesting fact is that rare earth elements and metals are not rare except for promethium, which happens to be radioactive.
Uh-oh.
And I'll get a little bit into why they're not rare in a minute. So the reason why we care about rare earth metals is because they're used in things like batteries and other green technologies like turbines. They're also found in some types of light bulbs are found in computers, LEDs, smartphones, hybrid vehicles. Yttrium can be used to make camera lenses and superconductors, as an example, and cell phone screens. So you may have heard in the past that there was a fear of rare earth shortage, but all indications say that that was not based on reality. Rare earth is actually plentiful. It's just hard to extract. And you may have heard in the news that a very large deposit of rare earth was found in a deep sea mud approximately 1,850 kilometers southeast of Tokyo. The deposit is located around the island of Minamitori in the Pacific Ocean. Researchers from Japan have estimated that in a 2,499 square kilometer area of seabed lies 16 million tons of rare earth oxides. Along with that estimate, they're saying that there is approximately 400 to 800 years worth of rare earth resources there, depending on the particular rare earth element we're talking about. Because the extraction process is so complicated, though, and expensive, some people speculate that it could take up to 5 years to figure out how to mine the deposits. I think it's way more than that. I was reading a varied degree of estimates on that number. It's probably going to be a lot longer because the deposits are 16,000 feet to 20,000 feet or 4,000 meters to 6,000 meters under the surface of the water. That's very far down. I'm pretty sure that we haven't even really mined anything that's that far down at this point. And there's also, on top of that, very serious environmental concerns, just disturbing the seabed to the degree that we would be disturbing it to mine all the regolith that we want and all these elements. It's just, it could be very hazardous and very dangerous to the ocean. So we got to be careful about that. I think a very important question here is how significant is this particular find? Now, people are saying things like it's a game changer. It has tremendous potential. This could be a huge, long-term, dramatic change on the impact of our technology and how much of it we have and everything. The reason is that even though these minerals are abundant, they're not likely to be so concentrated. And that's why this find is actually more significant than the other places where we get these materials from. It's because they are heavily concentrated. Now, you may have heard that they're saying that this is an unlimited supply. Of course, it's not unlimited, but they're saying, though, a supply level that they think that we have in front of us with what we're looking at, this could change, literally change society and our technology, because where certain materials were either, you know, you have to wait to get them or they're very expensive. Once they ramp this up and they fine tune the technology and all the things that we would need in order to extract this, and because it's going to be so consistently there for a very long time, well past all of our lives, it is going to have a dramatic effect on what we're going to achieve with these products, you know, with these elements. So, you know, I think this is encouraging. I think that there are a lot of experts saying, you know, double thumbs up, this is a great thing. There's going to be some time and consideration to get at it, but it's definitely there, and we're definitely going to go for it.
Yeah, as you said, Jay, it's not that the rare earths are rare. They're actually very common in the Earth's crust. Yttrium, for example, is more common than copper, but they don't occur in ores. They're not concentrated in nice ores that you could smelt, you know, and purify. They're more diffuse in the soil, and you have to use very toxic extraction methods. They're often, the deposits are laced with radioactive materials like thorium that have to be separated. The chemicals used in purifying them are often highly toxic themselves. Some estimates are that producing 1 ton of rare earths produces 2 tons of toxic sludge. And then that has to be stored safely somehow. Now, China has captured 85% of the rare earth market, largely because they were able to dump cheap rare earths onto the market. They forced out, for example, the only American company that was producing any significant amount of rare earths. And partly China does that by really skimping on their environmental practices, you know, like not having sufficiently lined beds for the toxic water, and then it seeps into the ground, for example. There have been many reports over the recent years about how, you know, horribly environmentally toxic the Chinese rare earth purification companies are. So it would be great, you know, to have another major player in the rare earth market, such as Japan. It's good that these are more highly concentrated, and, you know, hopefully that will enable them to compete with more environmentally friendly methods. I think that's going to be critical. It's unfortunate that it's so far under the water, and that's going to add, I think, a huge expense to their extraction. But the thing that there's like 400 to 800 years of rare earths down there is awesome. And even if it takes us 50 years to develop a technology to really extract, you know, economically extract those rare earths, you know, it's good to know that we're going to be set for a while. And that, of course, will give us so much time to, you know, advance technology that we can't really even think, you know, 400 years in the future. We can't say, like, are we going to be needing rare earths 400 years from now? Who the hell knows? We can't even predict. So for the foreseeable future, we know we have a supply of rare earths. And it is so important in so many different technologies. Gadolinium, which is a rare earth, is used in MRI scans as a contrast material, for example. You know, you mentioned just a few of them, but they do have really, really critical properties. They make the best super magnets. They are these soft ductile metals that have great physical properties in terms of conductance, etc. That's why they're used in so much technology like smartphones and computers and LED screens, etc. So I think this is encouraging overall.
Yeah, it's a great thing. I mean, if they can make it affordable and bring the pricing down in particular, this would be fantastic.
All right. Well, Kara is finally able to join us. Kara, thanks for jumping on.
Let's thank you to Time Warner, a.k.a. Spectrum, for allowing me to be here today.
Nice.
Yes, you're just your internet access just shit the bed yesterday. Is that what happened?
Yeah, it happens all the time in L.A. It's so frustrating.
Really?
Yes. It's so
Why
frustrating.
Is that?
It's not uncommon that you look up, you know, outages and stuff, and there's just like a massive red dot over Los Angeles. You're like, okay, cool.
Well,
that's the first time it's happened with us. We should just have a 4G backup. You know, all you need to do is be able to talk with us. You know, you can
that's
record
true. Like,
locally.
Just do it over my phone, like on LTE.
Yeah, or on an iPad or something. We'll do that.
That's
next
true.
Time.
I just got a new iPad, you guys. I'm so excited.
Oh yeah, the Ooh, new ones one? Are really
they
good.
Still those?
Well, I was going to get the new iPad Pro. I actually bought it, but then I realized that the new iPad, the new regular iPad, is supported, supports Apple Pencil. And so I compared them, and honestly, for my purposes, I don't really need all the fanciness of the iPad Pro, which costs twice as much. So I returned it, and I just got the 9.7-inch regular iPad. So now I'm going to start getting all my textbooks as ebooks. You can handwrite notes and then convert it into type. It's amazing.
Yeah, I use my iPad for my ebooks.
It's the best.
All right. Well, Kara, you are going to, we've spoken previously about the problem of plastics clogging up our oceans.
Yeah.
This time around, you're going to talk about possible solutions, including plastic eating bacteria.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've heard of some of the solutions that are on the horizon, like the big nets that have a fine mesh. I think one of them was invented by actually a schoolboy. A lot of really cool things that could help. But so far, we're having a problem, I think, with scalability and viability. And this solution is not that different, but it is something that's exciting, that's on everybody's radar. So, okay, let's break this down, no pun intended. PET, we've all heard of it, right? A plastic that's often used in bottles. Sometimes it's PETE is how it's written. You've seen it on the bottom of your bottles, those letters. Polyethylene, mm-hmm. Terephthalate or terephthalate, however you want to pronounce it. It takes over 400 years to environmentally decompose. It is recyclable, but it degrades each time it gets recycled. Now, here's just a couple stats, I think, to get in our heads why this is so dire. Globally, this blew my mind when I found this out. Globally, we are now using plastic bottles at a rate of 1 million per minute.
Oh!
What?
Yeah. Yeah. And only 9% of them worldwide are getting recycled.
Oh, that's not good. Not at all.
So there are estimates that by 2020, over half a trillion plastic bottles will be sold annually if we don't do anything, you know, legislatively to stop that. And by 2050, get this, oh gosh, the ocean will contain more plastic by weight than fish, and landfills will contain 12 billion metric tons of it. So it's not just all the plastic that's in the ocean, it's also in landfills at the same time. So you guys may have read about this recently discovered enzyme that actually breaks down plastic. It's called polyethylene terephthalatase, or PETase. That ase suffix is a typical suffix of enzymes. That's how you can usually identify them. It was originally discovered in Japan in a landfill. There's a special bacterium called Ideonella sakaiensis. I'm not sure how to pronounce that because it's a Japanese place where it was named for. And, you know, this was a news story, I think, a few years ago, but there's new research that's kind of added onto this. Before I get to that, I want you to keep in mind that polyethylene and other polyesters, polyethylene is a type of polyester, they've been around in nature for, you know, probably millions of years, at least thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. They protect the leaves of plants. So there's this thin kind of polyester film on a lot of different plant leaves. So bacteria have naturally evolved versions of polyester eating enzymes before. But this one was found in large quantities in a landfill, and it seemed to have evolved quite rapidly because PET has only been around for about 50 years, an ability to break down specifically PET. In this new study, researchers used molecular chemistry techniques where what they did was they made a 3D model of the PETase enzyme, the one that breaks it down, using something called an X-ray beamline at a lab in Oxfordshire in the UK. And then what they did is they played around with the residues on the surface of the enzyme and were able to figure out a more efficient way to have it bond to PET. So, you know, it shows that this evolved in nature, but obviously it wasn't perfected. And using some, you know, ingenious lab science, they could perfect the binding affinity of it to PET to help it break it down more efficiently. They also tested it on something called PEF plastic, which is a plant-based alternative that also degrades super slowly in nature. And they were excited because it actually worked better on PEF than PET. So that's like a double application there. So currently the way that, because, you know, we can all recycle our plastic bottles, right? Like a number one plastic is a PET plastic, a polyethylene terephthalate plastic. And you can throw that in the recycling bin and it actually does get broken down and then turned into something else. The problem is that you may have not known that plastic has like a downward quality spiral. So each time plastic is recycled, you can't use it for the same thing it was made for previously. You have to use it for something where you can have a worse quality plastic in it. So like lots of times you'll see that plastic bottles, which are clear and strong, will become like fleeces. And then those fleeces will go into carpet fibers. And it'll go down the chain until eventually it ends up in a landfill because you can't use it anymore. And so there's some correlation there with the numbers that you see on the bottom. bottom of plastic. They don't follow a perfect pattern, but the numbers actually do represent something, right? If you see a number one on the bottom inside those little arrows, the recycling symbol, number one plastics are PETs, like water bottles, cooking oil bottles, medicine containers. Number two is HDPE, high density polyethylene. You see that it's a little bit thicker in like laundry and dish detergent bottles, shampoo bottles, some toys. Number three is V, or polyvinyl chloride, which you see in pipes and shower curtains and medical tubing. Number four is low density polyethylene. So that's like wrappings, grocery bags, sandwich bags. Number five is polypropylene. That's a little thicker, like Tupperware, medicine containers. Number six is polystyrene. That's like styrofoam. Lots of times that's actually not recyclable. A lot of places will only recycle one through five. And then number seven is other. And other is a catch-all. It could be any combination of one through six or some other types of uncommonly used plastics. And most recycling facilities don't recycle number seven either because it's too complicated to separate it out. Remember that those numbers mean something. They use those numbers in recycling facilities. And depending on the quality of the plastic, the next time they use it, it's not going to be perfectly recyclable the way that aluminum and glass are. You can remake an aluminum can over and over and over. Same thing with paper. But with plastic, it only has a certain amount of life in its recycling ability. And the problem, too, is that that loop starts with what? What do we make plastic out of?
Petroleum.
Yeah. So it's not good. I mean, in many ways, it's not good. It's mucking up the oceans and the landfills. It doesn't break down naturally, at least not for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. It does break down physically to really small pieces in the ocean, but that just makes fish think it's plankton and fills up their guts, which is terrible. And it takes oil to make it. So we've got this problem, right, where there's a ton of plastic out there already. We keep making new plastic because we can't use the old plastic for high quality things like we want. So we keep making new plastic from oil. It's just a problem. So the hope is that using this kind of technology to using PETAs to break down plastic much more quickly into its component parts. That's what it does. That's the important thing, is that we can reuse those building blocks and make new plastics out of it, and what they call close the loop. But as we say on SGU all the time, we're about 5 to 10 years away from this probably being truly viable, because the problem is right now it takes a few days. And even though that sounds amazing, I mean, it's a massive improvement over 400 years. It's not economically viable. Like, recycling centers just won't use it if it only takes a few days, or if it still takes a few days. So they've got to figure out, first of all, how to increase the actual quantity of these enzymes and figure out how to make them scalable. And then second, it's got to be commercially viable. And the only way to make it commercially viable is to speed up the process. So they're just going to keep on working on it. But, you know, fingers crossed, this could be a really good thing for our very, very sick planet. Hopeful. It's hopeful, yeah, right?
It is. It is.
Kara, I read that most of the plastic that gets introduced to the ocean comes from, the bulk of it is coming from 10 rivers.
Yeah, I remember reading that too, that it's actually, there's these points of least resistance that a lot of it comes from. Yeah. And then some of it, of course, comes from coastal cities and things like that.
Yeah, and stuff that falls off of ships and everything. But I mean, I think when they did the review, they figured out that, you know, a lot of it is coming from these rivers that spill into the ocean. And, you know, I mean, look, I'm so far from being able to like talk about like what to do about that. But my brain immediately went to like big nets, you know, like can't they just capture all that crap?
Well, and they're working on it. You know, there's a lot of different things in place to work on it. But how's this for irony? One of the biggest problems in the ocean is big nets. You know, so like when you actually look at plastic,
we need bigger nets
refuse,
to catch all the other nets.
To catch all the nets, yeah. You do see it a lot. You see these large fish and large mammals that are getting strangled by these nets. You see them floating and clumping together. And the thing is, these nets are so good at catching other plastics that they form these big flotillas within the ocean where they just like grab a bunch of garbage. So like in a way that's good, but in another way it's quite dangerous. So yeah, I mean, there are a lot of really interesting technologies in use right now, but none of them I think are a real panacea. And it does seem like we're going to need something working at the molecular level like this, instead of just physically picking up all that plastic. Because regardless of if we can capture all of it in the ocean, what, we're just going to put it in the landfill. You know, we got to figure out how to get rid of it altogether.
Yeah, we got to try to turn it back into something useful.
It's really the only option we have because it's not going to go away, right? No matter what, we can't get rid of it. I remember I recently had this incredible woman on my podcast who, on my personal podcast, she wrote a book called, let me find her, Lori Winkless. She wrote a book about like the city, about how the city works, a lot of engineering stuff, but she's really interested in waste disposal also. She made this really wonderful comment in when I interviewed her that was like, where do you think away is? Like, you don't just throw things away. There is no away.
The sun.
Like, we have to, mindful of like what we're talking about when we talk about away. And I think that's a really important point. Oh, yeah. Science and the City. Highly recommend it. Very good book. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, even if you had a machine that could atomize garbage, there's going to be a lot of atoms.
Yeah, you got to do something with those atoms. And that's like best case scenario, right?
Wouldn't we sequester it like we do spent nuclear material?
Yeah, and even that is a massive problem. Like, where do we put it? We end up burying it. And then we have all of these issues around how do we, like, how do we tell future generations that it's dangerous and you shouldn't dig here for fossil fuels or, you know, put any sort of building materials here because it's going to be radioactive for tens of thousands of years? Are they even going to speak the same language in tens of thousands of years?
Yeah, they came up with like a sign that basically shows like somebody melting, I think.
Yeah, but then it's like, what makes us think that sign is going to last that long? I mean, there's just a lot of issues.
Even if it does, it's funny. You can look at a sign with like symbols, like if you go near this, you will die type of easy stuff. And it's so funny because there's so many other interpretations that you wouldn't think of that also make a lot of sense, especially when you're not, you know, you're so far removed from the culture that you're in.
Yes, yeah. They're so culture bound. Like a sign that says you could melt by going here might be read by another culture as yummy food down below.
Yeah, or shrink your waist and lose weight by touching this.
Yeah, they'll
figure
it. Know.
Yeah, they'll figure it
out.
Yeah,
like
fast.
The gold record, right, on Voyager. Like, I don't know. Looks kind of sexual to me. Just saying.
But basically, you know, for any major technology or any major part of the technological ecosystem, we need to think about the entire life cycle, you know, from beginning to end.
Yeah, know? That's become a theme on SGU lately, right? Whenever we talk about satellites and how, you know, putting things out there in low Earth orbit, we got to figure out how they're going to end their lives. There's a lot of things where historically we just weren't forward thinking.
Yeah, of course.
We're too excited getting there in the first place.
You know, well, the environment was always a bottomless pit. And now it isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't,
of course,
either for resources or as a disposal.
And of course, there were always forward-thinking authors who I think really warned us about this. And that's why I love kind of mid-century sci-fi. You know, that's why I love Bradbury. Didn't he write an awful lot about plastic and kind of warn us about the problems with it? Because they saw it. They were really early futurists.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time?
I will deal with the noisy from 2 weeks ago soon. But last week, I played a special noisy, which
noisy.
I will a who noisy. And here it is. Here's what I played last week. Now, I was kind of surprised that I didn't get a ton of emails. I didn't get a ton. But I had a couple of funny things. One person wrote in, it's audio of people talking, played, sped up, and then played with church bells in the background.
Wow.
That's my guess. Yeah. I'm with you.
That to the next step, and what do you got?
So
the people who got it actually took the time to slow it down, right? Because nobody could just recognize that by their ear.
Yeah, so that's the big trick here. The trick was this was an Easter egg. This actually was the very first SGU legit Easter egg. That was in celebration of episode 666. And if you paid attention and you did slow it down, here is actually what you heard.
Hey, good job. You found the secret message. Now all you have to do is listen to the following clip taken from one of my favorite movies and tell me what passage in the Bible was this clip taken from. And then email me the answer at info@theskepticsguide.org. Good luck. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the enemies of the selfish and the children of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness. For he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost sheep. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brother. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Samuel Jackson in Pulp Fiction when he's quoting the Bible before he kills those kids. Say what again? So,
is that one of your favorite movies?
Oh yeah, Pulp Fiction is a masterpiece.
I watched it recently. It's a very good movie.
It is a very good movie.
It does everything right, in my opinion. Just a fantastic film. Yeah, I mean, I thought that was, you know, that Bible quote was very funny, and to me, there's something. And, you know, there's something about the way that Samuel Jackson says that particular line that just tweaks me. Like, I love it so much. One of my fantasies is to have him yell at me. I want Samuel Jackson to yell at me. Just to, you know, his whole shtick.
Really, Jay?
Yeah, this would be fun. You know, of course, I don't mean for him to actually be angry at me. I just would like to hear that. But bottom line is, three people figured it out. But there can be only one. Yes.
There can be only one.
The three people are in order of when I got the email. So the first person I read is the winner. Håkon Lund is the winner. Great job. Absolutely great job. The second person to send in the correct answer was Joshua Twilley. Excellent job, Joshua. And Joey Batera also sent it in. These three people figured it out. It was a legit Easter egg. I've been telling Steve for years we wanted to mess around with putting an Easter egg in or having some type of thing happen where people, if they were paying real attention and they caught on to it, that there would be puzzles and stuff. But this was about as much time as we could, you know, piece together to do it. Pretty obvious, though, now that you hear it, right? There's sped up talking, right? I just thought Steve really was like, Jay, you can't make it too obvious. I mean, everyone's going to figure it out. I'm like, no, I don't think so. My gut told me that it wasn't going to be an avalanche, but I thought we'd get more than three people. But that's good. I guess that's just about the right
Three's
number
good.
If you
Three's
think
good.
About it. What is this person going to win?
Oh, they're actually going to win something?
Oh, yes. This Håkon Lund won something significant from the SGU. Steve and I threw around some ideas. Steve, did you finalize what you think would be adequate for this hoop we had him jump through?
A pair of edible underwear.
Yes.
What? No.
No.
No. No. Oh, he's going to get to join us for Science or Fiction.
All right.
Oh, hey.
Yes. Excellent. Yes. So, Håkon, you can first tell me how to pronounce your name. And then second, I will be emailing you, or you can email me. We'll email each other, and we will discuss this. We'll schedule it, and we'll have you on the show. Of course, that's only if you want to be on the show. But thank you, guys. This was a lot of fun. You know, the bell tolling, my idea for this noisy was that the bell tolling was supposed to be the big distraction, but when you slow it way down, the bell sound almost disappears because it's just becomes such a low sound that you can't even hear it. And that was like the little audio thing that I did there. It was a lot of fun making it. And I also had a lot of fun making the intro to the show last week. Moving onward, sir. We had a noisy. I will remind you of the noisy right now that I played 2 weeks ago, and that noisy is this one. You cannot tell me this isn't funny.
What the hell?
It's so horrifying.
Bob, this is just the best part of the clip. I love the end. I got a lot of funny things in, of course, on this one. Mark Genist from Edmonton, Canada said, great show. Is this the sound of tuna fishing reel? Is this the sound of a tuna fishing reel with a fish on it? No.
Oh, my gosh. How sad.
I know. Because if that's what tuna fishing sounded like, I would never do it. That's horrible. Imagine hearing that for 8 hours. Like, get out of here. Jesse Dill said, I've been listening to the show for a couple of years now. I never miss a show. Love it. I can't wait to give out the book for Christmas. I think that is a Jesse, did you come up with that idea? Because that is an amazing idea. Did you guys hear what she said? Or he? Could be a guy.
One more time.
I've been listening to the show for a couple of years now. I never miss a show. Love it. I can't wait to give out the book for Christmas.
Genius.
What book is he talking about, Jeff?
Oh, that wow. must be the new SGU book, Steve.
Our
Available
book.
You mean
on
the Amazon.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe?
Yes, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe book coming out October 2nd.
Oh, my gosh.
But you can pre-purchase the book now, and we would really appreciate it if you do, because we want to get on a bestsellers list.
Well, it actually helps a promotion of the book in a lot of ways.
Yeah, a publisher actually turns on their effort to sell the book when we get on a bestsellers list. So it's actually important for us to get there. But anyway, the book.
Also, I don't know if you know this, but it comes out like 2 weeks before my birthday. And I can't think of a better birthday present than you guys buying the book.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Anyway, I just thought that it was nice that you said that, Jesse. But Jesse finishes the email with, I think this week's Noisy is a sample of Return of the Night of the Living Dead. Keep up the awesome work.
Is it really?
Yeah, and I'm confused. I mean, you know, I get these emails, and a lot of times they don't identify, like, what episode they're responding to. But I just thought that was apropos, and I thought Bob would like it. So I included
so
that
email. So Return of the Night of the Living Dead?
Yes.
So not actually correct.
No.
All right. I have a couple of close guesses here. Zachary Dorma said screaming sheep, ? No, but we're getting closer. Justin Smith said cats, definitely cats. Two cats in a Mexican standoff about to go fur balls to the walls in a feline showdown to the death. That was closer. Good guess, Justin. The correct answer and the winner came from Richard Smith. Richard said, funnily enough, I just rewatched this video the other day. It's two lynx having a not too civil disagreement over territory.
No way.
That's what a lynx sounds like?
That's horrifying.
It actually, it's from a clip sent in from Carolyn Boyd, and it's two lynx going back and forth, and they think that it might be something to do with mating. You tell me. Here it is again. I love that.
Yes, it has to do with mating. You're trying to scare away the other alpha male.
Yeah,
so
like if that has anything to do with mating, you're not a mammal. Anyway, thank you for that. That was a lot of fun. We're definitely on like my top 10 funniest noises of all time, maybe even my top 5. That was great. I have a new noisy this week. It was sent in by a listener named Daryl Thayer. Daryl, absolutely love this noisy. Thank you so much for sending it in. We'll talk more about Daryl next week. In the meantime, here is the noisy. Wait till you find out what this one is. It's really cool. If you're a geek, I'll put that in there. So if you heard any cool noisies this week, if you want to say hi, or if you want to guess on what the answer is, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
No, what's funny, if you go to Amazon, they have the frequently bought together suggestion, and they have our book paired with A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo.
Oh, yeah, the bunny book. I bought it.
The bunny book from John Oliver.
Did you guys see that episode?
Oh, my God. I am proud to share.
Hell yeah.
Page space with that.
That just means that our listeners are super woke. That makes me happy.
Yep.
Super.
Yeah, yeah.
Super.
Okay. Thanks, Jay.
Oh, gosh.
We have one email. This comes from David Morris from Bristol, England.
I see.
And David writes, hi, thank you for the show. I enjoy it and appreciate the chance to learn. I listened to your discussion of the alkaline diet and with some interest. Midway through last December, I was diagnosed with having silent heartburn. I'd have a rough few months with a progressively worsening cough. I'd had to start trying to sleep sitting up in a chair and had passed out and collapsed at one point due to coughing. When I got to the respiratory clinic, I was surprised to be told my lungs were fine, but I had a form of indigestion where I didn't feel the discomfort of indigestion, but my throat and lungs were being irritated, causing the coughing. I was prescribed omeprazole, ranitidine, and a peptic liquid, and saw immediate improvement. However, I was also advised to cut down my intake of citrus fruits, coffee, tea, sugar, and things like chili. Mm-hmm. Is this just some woo that infected the NHS, or did I misunderstand that part of your discussion, which sounded like there aren't foods or drinks that encourage an acid stomach?
Oh, no. It seems like a lot of people are misunderstanding, because we were talking about once things get to your stomach.
Yeah, we
never really talked about the esophagus. But,
exactly.
I think we did make a disclaimer at the end that high acid foods can actually irritate your esophagus if you're sensitive to that. Did we not?
I don't remember doing that. But that's the distinction, Carrie. You hit upon it. So this is for reflux disease, right? So reflux means that you have an incompetent sphincter.
Sorry. That is such a funny thing to say.
It sounds like a really sophisticated insult. Like, yeah. What's an incompetent sphincter? You have to say it with a British accent. No, but you have the gastric sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach. If that allows stomach acid to, you know, it doesn't close all the way, so the stomach acid splashes into your esophagus, it damages the esophagus because the stomach is lined and protected from the acid, but the esophagus isn't. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get heartburn. That burning is your esophagus.
Oh, I hate that.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you have that and your esophagus is damaged, then really acidic foods could irritate your already damaged esophagus. So the reason why you might want to avoid highly acidic or other kinds of foods are to reduce the stress on the esophagus that has already been damaged. It's not about the stomach. It's not about the acid in the stomach itself. However,
now I remember we did not a disclaimer, but we mentioned at the end that it could be bad for your teeth too.
Your teeth. You said teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah, not the esophagus.
Yeah. We did talk about something else that wasn't stomach.
Yeah.
Phosphoric.
Yeah. It was the teeth. Mm-hmm. But there's also something else. The reason that, well, coffee could be on the list for two reasons. Coffee is acidic, but it also has caffeine in it. And do you know what caffeine does?
Yes.
Opens up your sphincter?
It relaxes your sphincter. It relaxes your sphincter. And so.
Coffee enema? What?
So coffee is bad.
Yuck.
Anything with caffeine. Caffeine is bad if you have reflux disease. And it's also bad to take right before you go to bed because when you lay down, then you can get reflux because you're laying down. That's why he talked about sleeping sitting up, right? Because then the stomach mm-hmm. acid could flow back into your esophagus. So caffeine right before you lay down or go to sleep is a bad idea as well. However,
Generally speaking, I looked at
the research to see, you know, how solid is the actual evidence for this. And it's actually pretty weak.
Evidence for what?
The evidence that citrus fruits or acidic foods are bad for acid reflux.
Oh, interesting.
It's mainly case reports or small studies. It's not a home run. So, but it's always that question of, do you make generally benign recommendations to patients based upon preliminary evidence that may help, you know? Mm-hmm. So the evidence is less than solid, but telling people, you might decide to cut back on these foods, it may help. You know, it's a pretty benign recommendation to make. And generally we tell patients, you know, if it bothers you, don't do it kind of thing. Like, so just watch out for it. You might find that like drinking orange juice is painful. If that's the case, it could be irritating your esophagus. If it doesn't bother you, then don't worry about it. Right.
It seems like, you know, all the over the counter or even the prescription heartburn medications in their commercials, they always show. And I guess it's also the folk wisdom that just like eating garbage food gives you worse.
Yeah.
Heartburn.
Yeah.
Like eating chicken wings and
chili.
French fries.
Yeah.
Yeah. And stuff. And like, is there a lot of evidence to support that?
No.
Okay. Interesting.
No, I mean, you know, so ulcers are caused mainly by H. pylori infection.
Yeah.
It really doesn't have to do with your diet. And, you know, your reflux disease has to do with your sphincter. Doesn't really have to do with your diet. The diet is just not the thing. I mean, it makes like sort of a crude sense to think that what you eat is affecting your stomach, you know, but it just turns out not to be the case. Again, there is some evidence that these kind of acidic foods may be painful to an already damaged esophagus, but that's about it.
So is stress contributing to an ulcer? Is that a
no,
myth?
That's a myth. Myth. Yeah, it's a myth.
Interesting.
All right, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
No theme or anything, just three regular but very interesting news items.
Mm.
All right, here we go. No whining. Item number one. Researchers have discovered how to make diamonds flexible and stretchy.
What?
Item number two. Engineers have developed a new technique for streaming video 10,000 times faster than the current best algorithms. And item number three, a new analysis finds that humans are responsible for a mass extinction of large mammals over the last 120,000 years. Kara, I don't think you've gone first in a while.
I haven't. Well, at first, when you read the first two, I was thinking, I'm going to pick my answer this week based on which ones I want to be true and I hope to be true. And then the one that I hope isn't true will be the fiction. Unfortunately, you read a super negative one third, and I think that it's true. I think it might be science. So researchers have discovered how to make diamonds flexible and stretchy. Kind of neutral to that. Don't really care if there's a flexible or stretchy diamond. Don't know why you would want one either, because it seems like the main perks of diamonds are that A, they're sparkly and pretty, and that's why people like them, and B, they're really hard, and you can use them to cut into things that you can't cut with other tools.
They had one in Futurama. Futurama predicted that.
Wait, why would you want that? I don't know. I'm very confused. Okay,
Kara,
engineer.
Kara,
yes.
Do you like Mrs. Bottle?
Oh, God.
Exactly.
Good job, Steve.
Engineers have developed a new technique for streaming video 10,000 times faster than the current best algorithms. That sounds awesome. Not that probably the streaming speeds aren't sufficient now, but, you know, anything where I can watch Netflix faster sounds amazing. And a newest analysis also won't even be relevant because of net neutrality. Let's see what else. A new analysis finds that humans are responsible for mass extinction of large mammals over the last 120,000 years. I mean, I don't see how this one could be fiction. Because, like, how many mammals? Even if it's just two mammals, then that's two large mammals. We have to have been responsible for at least two
mass
large...
extinction. Mass
oh,
extinction.
Shit. You're right. Okay. What qualifies as a mass extinction, Steve?
That's right.
A lot? I don't know.
There aren't that many large mammals anyway.
Now? Just...
Well, actually...
Yeah, if you were around 120,000 years ago.
Okay. Really quick and dirty, and I know that some fans who have written in said that they like to hear a thought process. So I'm actually going to give you my thought process on this one. When I was in the Amazon, I was walking with a botanist and he was telling me about, he calls these big, big, beautiful trees in the Amazon. He calls them charismatic megaflora, which is hilarious. Mm. And he talks about how they have these massive fruits that are remnants from an earlier era that no forest animals today are appropriate dispersers of, because these fruit, nobody can swallow them and pass them. So they provide evidence to the fact that there used to be enormous anteaters, like bigger than the giant anteaters that are there now, enormous elephants, even these massive creatures that used to roam the Peruvian Amazon. We know that they must have existed because of the plants that lived there and because of the types of seeds that they dropped. So, I'm going to say that humans are responsible for mass extinction of large mammals over the last 120,000 years. The other two, it's a crapshoot. I have no idea. I'm going to go with the fiction is the 10,000 times faster and say it was like 1,000 times faster, that it's an order of magnitude issue.
Okay, Bob.
I think somebody said, why would you want to make diamonds flexible and stretchy? I mean, sure, you lose the classic hardness, but you also, I mean, diamonds conduct heat faster than almost anything. So if you could have something
that.
That's flexible and stretchy and then have it be a good conductor like that, then that'd be great. But I mean, sure. Make diamonds flexible. I mean, I could see, you know, making little chips and putting them on a flexible substrate type of thing, but then that's really not the spirit of what you're saying here, I guess. I don't know about that one. Yeah, the streaming video, 4 orders of magnitude faster. I mean, what the hell? That's just, that's insane. That's just such a huge improvement. Let's see. Yeah, the mass extinction one, I'm just going to totally buy that. I mean, isn't the jury still out? I mean, Don't people think that that we were critically responsible for like the extinction of mammoths and other megafauna like that? I mean, I know they're not sure, and it could have been environmental, but I think a lot of people think that we had a big hand in that. And of course, that doesn't go back 120,000 years. That's only 5 to 15,000 years. Diamonds flexible and stretchy. That's just like, how are you going to do that? It's not diamond anymore if you could do that.
That's what I was going to say. Why would you call it diamond then?
You're going to gather these. I mean, it could be industrial grade diamonds that aren't very expensive and then use them. Or they're doing great stuff with synthetic diamonds and you could use that and make that flexible. But you're not going to take these gem quality diamonds. And here's a little piece of diamond silly putty that costs about $900,000. That could be very helpful. All right. I'm going to GWC go with the 10,000 times faster. It's too much. 4 orders of magnitude. It's like wicked.
All right, Evan.
All right. The flexible diamonds and stretchy, nonetheless. Well, I'll stick with my what I said earlier about Futurama having predicted that one to be the case. 1,000 years from now,
what was the reason, Evan?
It was a diamond tether that the ship has, and they used it as like a fishing line. They put a big hook on the end of it and decided to catch fish with it. There's something to that effect. You know, silly. But I mean, even though we may not be able to think about what the end use of a product like this would be, but the fact that they can just do it, I think, is not beyond our reach. And then the second one about engineers developing the technique for streaming video 10,000 times faster. Okay. I mean, I'm thinking this one's right because, you know, they developed the technique for it. I mean, it's not like it's ready to go to the market. Everybody can have this thing. You know, it's under these sort of, I would suppose, optimal conditions and hooking up these special computers that nobody has access to on a regular basis. And right. So they were able to game the computer world in a sense to make it that it could possibly happen, that technique. By no means are they saying that this is ready for prime time. I have a feeling that one's going to be right. And that leaves me with having to choose the extinction one as the fiction.
Crap.
But I don't know. But I don't know why. I mean, when did humans start playing with fire? I mean, was that 120,000 years ago? Is that why? Would that be the reason? Why? I don't quite know. I don't know how humans could have been responsible for it 120,000 years ago. I mean, there's only been civilizations for what, like maybe 50,000 years at the furthest back? I have a few pieces of knowledge missing there to really put this one together. I'm going to say, though, that one, 120,000 years, nope, for mass extinction, that's the fiction.
And Jay.
So stretchy diamonds. Yeah, I kind of agree with Bob. Is it a diamond at that point if they were able to do something to carbon? I don't know. I mean, it would be amazingly useful, though, Kara. Like if you had a material that was flexible or stretchy, depending on how stretchy it is, you know, yet how rigid it could be, you could do some remarkable things with it.
See, you can tell that I am not, or why I am not a material science, because every time we get these kinds of prompts, I'm always like, why would you want that? What would that do?
And we're like, oh, Kara, this would change everything.
I mean, the first thing I thought about was like a spaceship. I have to admit, like just...
See that? Futurama. Yeah.
Remember that book, Bob, Sentence to Prism?
Shit, yeah. Alan Dean Foster. Loved it.
Yep. Yeah, I met him because of Michael Whalen. I got to meet that
guy. Oh, wow, nice.
Yeah, it was cool. I'm not, you know, that first one is bothering me because I just don't think it's diamonds at that point, but I could see how Steve would argue against that. So I'll move on to the next one. Engineers take streaming video 10,000. Yeah, this was the one that stood out for me. 10,000 times faster is just so remarkably faster than like the fastest speeds that we have today. Are you saying the best algorithms? All right. That's the tricky part there. 10,000 times faster than the current best algorithms. Even still, 10,000 times faster, even with an improved algorithm or a collection of algorithms, it's way too much growth in one step. So I'm like 99% sure that one is the fiction. Moving on to the last one.
Why would you need to move on if you're 99%?
I just want to read it again because you guys took so freaking long. I actually forgot what it said. Humans responsible for mass extinctions. Yes, I agree. Humans are responsible for the mass extinctions of mammals for 120,000 years. Yes, that sounds exactly like what we do. And you know what? Watch us go because we're not even close to being done. We keep on the trail that we're on right now. We're gonna total our planet. Anyway. I mean,
weren't Cro-Magnons around then, too?
I know, Ev, right?
Weren't they responsible to some degree?
Yeah, we call someone a Cro-Magnon like to insult them, and we're dumber than they are because look at what we're doing to our planet. Anyhow, Evan, I think this 10,000 time thing, that is such a crock of shit, Steve. No wow. way. Are we anywhere near that? So,
See, if we had the opportunity, I think I would change my answer to Evans, but I can't, and I have to stick with the 10,000 times faster.
Wow. Holy shit. So after I go, she's like, you know, if I could,
she failed.
I changed my answer away from Jay's.
I think Evan convinced me at the 120,000 years.
Oh, gosh.
Thing.
Well, I guess we will find out in a moment.
As always, there are hidden
questions in these items. Like, for example, how big are these diamonds? Or over what distance can they stream the video? Or what role did climate change have in the mass extinction of large mammals over the last 120,000 years? And over what time period are we really talking about? Was it 12,000 or was it 120,000?
But also 12,000 is included in 120,000.
Yes, but 120,000 is not included in 12,000.
Exactly.
What's that?
There's questions to all of these. They could potentially be correct or wrong depending on which way the answers go.
You're so evil, Steve.
You all agree in the first one, so we'll start there. Researchers have discovered how to make diamonds flexible and stretchy. You all think that one is science.
Uh-huh.
And that one is science.
Yes.
Aha. How do you think they did it? So they're still diamond. They are still completely 100% diamond. Normally, diamonds have an elasticity of basically 1%. In other words, you could deform them by about 1% before they will snap, right? Before
wow.
they'll break.
Yeah,
that's
so they're brittle.
They're brittle, yeah.
They're hard as hell.
These diamonds can stand an 1.5%. Elastic strain up to 9%.
Which that's much higher.
That's a lot higher. 1% to 9% is actually a lot higher.
That's a good size jump.
They achieved that.
Not that I would still call it flexible and stretchy, but continue.
If you see the video of it, you would say, yeah, that's flexible. It's
really?
Bending.
9%?
It could bend 9% and then come all the way back into its original shape.
Yeah, that's implied.
So, yeah. But the way they do that is by making nano diamond needles. They stretch it out into these tiny little needle diamonds, and then those are very, very flexible, you know, compared to regular diamonds.
Yeah, because the 9% shows up is more dramatic in that one dimension. It's more like the expansion of space. The longer the distance, the more dramatic all that expansion is.
Bob, do you get like goosebumps when you hear the phrase nano diamond needle?
I think if you were strapped to my heart rate or something, or blood pressure, you'd see a little beep, beep.
Yeah.
a nano peak.
Barely measurable.
So, you know, what use would this be, Kara, right?
Yes. Why would anybody want this?
They don't know, but they do say.
That makes you feel a little better.
Yeah, right.
That, hang on. It opens up unprecedented possibilities for tuning its optical, optomechanical, magnetic, phononic, and catalytic properties.
That's a lot. That's
cool.
So
that's cool.
It just creates a lot of possibilities. You know, anytime you find ways of manipulating matter into different forms, you know, it always opens up the possibility that we could find something useful for it.
Plastic
so, like,
bottles.
Say we are clever chimps, and we are good at figuring crap like that out.
Too clever. All right. Sometimes.
Sometimes. Let's go on to number two. Engineers have developed a new technique for streaming video 10,000 times faster than the current best algorithms. Evan, you think this one is science. Everyone else thinks this one is the fiction.
Ugh.
Evan, you have sometimes you go out on your own and you're the sole winner.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Sometimes not. And this time, this one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Sorry, Evan.
Yes. Thank you, Steve, for not letting us change our answers.
Yeah. Thanks for sticking to the rules.
Yeah. But researchers did achieve HD video streaming at 10,000 times lower power, not faster.
Wow. Oh, that's where you got the number from.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's still cool. I don't know, how applicable it's going to be. It's interesting, though. They use the technique called backscatter. Bob, are you familiar with the backscatter?
Yeah, I've heard of it, definitely.
Yeah, so it's a way of sending – it's a different way of sending data, and it's only usable under short distances. So I'm not really sure how useful it's going to be in terms of like streaming things over the internet. But they demonstrate – previously it was thought that this backscatter technique could only be used for very low data rates, but they were able to show that you could stream HD video, you know, using backscatter. Essentially, it encodes the pixel data in the duration and intensity of the photons, you know. So, like, the longer they are, the brighter the pixel. And so it's just a clever way of encoding it in this backscatter
cool.
of light.
But it has a limited range.
But it does require very low power. They were able to do 720 HD videos at 10 frames per second to a device up to 14 feet away.
So you could potentially, say, stream video from your computer to your phone or your TV or something
That's
like
it.
That.
That's exactly it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but nobody's watching 720. Come on.
No, so what? Make it HD or even 4K, and that's still a respectable power
utilization. 720 is fine for your phone, Kara.
Yeah, right. That's true for your phone.
And that's what this would be useful for, small devices that don't have a lot of power. It's exactly what it would be useful for.
I'll give them that.
All right, so what do you get? As long as you won, right?
All right, that all means that a new analysis finds that humans are responsible for a mass extinction of large mammals over the last 120,000 years is science. Now, you guys are familiar with the age of gigantism, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Back in, hundreds of thousands to millions of years ago, there was this period where there were lots of gigantic, massive animals. And then over the last 120,000 years, the average size of mammals has been steadily decreasing. There's been an asymmetrical extinction where the larger a mammal is, the more likely it is to go extinct. It hasn't really been known exactly what caused that phenomenon. One major hypothesis was that it was climate change favoring smaller body size. However, the recent study shows that it tracks awfully well to human migrations around the world.
Oh,
that
nice.
Every time and place that humans go, the large megafauna starts to die out.
You bastards.
And is that because
we kicked their asses?
We hunted them, but is it also because we competed for other resources with them?
They think it's hunting.
Yeah, because it's like, why kill 10 small things if you can kill one really big thing?
You kill one really big thing, you feed your village for a week. You know, it's a no-brainer. And the bottom line was that once we got to the point where we had the weapons and the technique of group hunting, once we got to the point where we were really successful megafauna hunters, you know, it was just, you know, cost-effective in terms of our effort to kill bigger and bigger animals.
Yeah, bigger return on the investment.
Yeah.
A walking supermarket.
Steve,
and
you know
Evan,
how it
we
works,
need-
right? It's mm-hmm. first you get the spears. Then you get the meat, and then you get the
then
women.
You get the women.
Then you get the women.
Oh, no. What is that from?
Scarface.
Oh, come on.
Scarface.
Evan, I was going to say that it wouldn't matter if we weren't yet in kind of agrarian societies. Or like hunter-gatherers predated agrarian societies and what we think of as modern civilization. Like we had spear points.
Yeah.
Hundreds, you know, or at least tens of thousands of years ago.
And sometimes they would drive animals over cliffs. You know, they wouldn't even need the spears necessarily.
Yeah.
It's just that we were really smart. You know, we had our brains.
Mm-hmm.
What were Cro-Magnon doing around that time?
Well, Cro-Magnon, by the way, are modern, fully modern Homo sapiens, right? And they come around 30,000 years ago. And they were cave dwellers and they were big game hunters, absolutely.
Right. So they participated in the...
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So therefore... A more complete correct answer would have been a new analysis finds that humans and Cro-Magnons are responsible.
No, Cro-Magnon, he just said Cro-Magnons are
humans.
Human.
They are human.
No, you said
Homo sapien.
Homo sapien. They are fully human.
They are fully human.
Yeah, Cro-Magnons are a race. That's like saying Europeans, you know. Mm-hmm.
But I bet you Neanderthal was also part of this.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, but that's okay. That doesn't make the rest of it incorrect. Correct.
Sure.
We're just really successful hunters. That's
right.
The bottom line.
Yeah, we work well together, too.
That's right.
This is not something to be proud of, people. This is very sad.
We are
hunters.
Kicking this planet's ass like nobody's business.
Well, and it's still happening, if you
think
about it.
That's what the researchers say. This is just something people do.
Yeah.
That's what they included.
Yeah. But like, even still, what we think of as charismatic megafauna is, by and large, is endangered.
Yeah, and they say that there's no reason to think this trend has stopped, that we're still killing off megafauna, and they project it into the future, and pretty soon there's not going to be any large mammals at all.
Nope, except in zoos. It's very sad. Right. And actually, I read a recent study. I think it's one of the ones that I pitched to you, Steve, that was really interesting because it was showing that these animals that we think of as being these charismatic, like the animals that we decorate our children's bedrooms with and tell nighttime stories about – it may be the case that because they're so beloved, it's actually correlated with their endangerment simply because they did a survey and asked people about the status of these animals. And the ones that most people recognize by name, I think because they're so ubiquitous in their storytelling, they think are ubiquitous on the planet as well.
Yeah, it's the availability heuristic.
Yeah. Which is sad because they're definitely not.
You think that things that readily come to mind are common, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But unfortunately, they're actually probably much more
rare.
Time
to step up our cloning efforts.
Yeah. Well, cloning doesn't give you genetic diversity. That's the big problem.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we have CRISPR
step
now.
Step up
so.
A lot of efforts.
Yeah, I guess so. But genetic diversity.
A lot of very easy things we can do that we're just not doing.
Yeah. Or we could not kill them off, you know.
Exactly. That's one of them.
Yeah, like gorillas, you know, are one of the charismatic megafauna, and they're really critically endangered. You know?
Almost every great ape is like horribly critically endangered.
It's a horrible
orangutans
thought.
Are really bad too. Yeah, I know, it's terrible. And rhinoceros, we saw, like,
oh,
there are
gosh,
none
the
left
last
of the white
rhinoceros.
I know.
All right. Yeah, sorry to have such a sad item in the section, but
thanks a lot, asshole.
Good job, guys. All right, Evan, you have a quote for us?
Yeah, I do. If a little kid ever asks you just why the sky is blue, you look at him or her right in the eye and say, it's because of quantum effects involving Rayleigh scattering combined with a lack of violet photon receptors in our retina. Phil Plait.
Okay. Oh, of course that's Phil Plait.
Of course it's Phil. Brilliant. And I think his point here is, hey.
Don't dumb it down.
Right. Teach them the science. You know, if they've got the questions, you either say you don't know and you look it up together with them.
Yeah.
Or you give them the straight poop. You don't come up with, you know, some sort of fantasy tale or something that's fluffy and nice and something outside the truth.
Yeah, and I get Phil's point, but I would back that up with a little bit more age-appropriate language description of what's going on. I that was always my approach, is you sort of give them, you know, you got to be right. It's a carrot thing, you know. You want the challenge to be just in front of the person. If it's too far out in front, they're lost.
They glaze over.
If it's not out in front at all, then they don't advance. If you just, right, that's why like video game type algorithms are so effective at training, because it constantly keeps the challenge rating right in front of where you currently are. But also, the other point here is that we tend to think kids are stupid. It's just our
yeah.
And many are.
Yeah, they, you know, meaning that compared to adults. Obviously,
they don't have much vocabulary yet.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, obviously, brains. Yeah, they have immature brains and they lack a lot of knowledge and they lack, you know, sophistication, etc. But you, generally speaking, it's been my experience, and I think this is borne out by evidence, that we tend to underestimate rather than overestimate their intelligence, and that you're more likely to be inappropriately talking down to kids. And rather, you should give them the benefit of the doubt, talk a little bit above the level where you think you should be, and you're probably going to be appropriate. Mm. You know, so I always would give like my daughters or whoever who ask a question the benefit of the doubt and give them, you know, you got to just make sure you're limiting the jargon, right? Yeah, don't use words they don't understand, but don't dumb down the complexity or the nuance or the real understanding of the answer. Give kids the credit for being smart, and they will rise to it.
And the good news is, if they don't know what you're talking about, they'll keep asking you questions.
And they'll freaking ask.
You hope so, right? That's the point.
And you know, there's obviously a skill to being a good teacher, but it's worth developing that skill. If you're raising kids, then you are their most significant teacher. You know,
mm-hmm.
But if you dumb it down, you know, and you underestimate their knowledge and ability. It's a completely wasted opportunity. You're going to bore them. You're going to, you know, it's only bad things will come about. You very rarely will lose anything by assuming they're smarter than you think they are. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think that's what Phil was getting at. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, Steve.
Don't forget about our Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/theskepticsguide to look at all kinds of great stuff that we give our listeners who support us. Jay, you're uploading the pre-show banter.
Yep. By the time this show comes out, I'll have had a new one come up by the end of this week, which means it should be there if you are a patron. And yeah, so the pre-show banter is a lot of fun. It's basically I had been stealthily recording the all of us during the half an hour before we do the show, we talk for a little while, and then we record our ads and all that stuff. And I did it for 2 years, and these guys didn't really know what was happening. And I just have a lot of gems, and people are really enjoying what I'm putting up. So there's some crazy discussions that we have that are not like SGU appropriate. You have to be a member to hear them.
I'm so scared.
Don't worry. Most of it's not incriminating.
Sure.
And don't forget about Nexus, our annual conference that we hold in New York City every year, July 12th through 15th. Go to necss.org. You can see the full list of speakers. We have a great lineup this year, including Jennifer Ouellette as our keynote speaker. Of course, the SGU will be there with our live show, our private show, meeting and greeting all the attendees. I'd like to see a lot of our listeners there. Lots of great workshops. Check it out. Hope to see you all there. All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
God bless you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.